Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Eric Dyson, one of America's premier public intellectuals and the author of the New York Times bestseller, Tears We Cannot Stop. He is the University Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University, contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, and a contributing editor of The New Republic and ESPN's The Undefeated. His latest book just out is What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversations About Race in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Eric Dyson.
Hello, my friend. It's great to be on your show.
Well, thank you, Michael. And just our previous segment was on Donald Trump's canceling the Philadelphia Eagles in a rather petulant way because they weren't going to show up. And he had, of course, his ego is such that he had to preemptively cancel them. But essentially what Trump is saying here is he's appointing himself as the arbiter of what patriotism is in this country. And if you don't meet my standard of patriotism, you don't get invited to my house. Of course, the White House is the people's house, but Trump is acting as though the White House is the latest real estate acquisition by the Trump Organization.
Absolutely right. I mean, it's vicious. It's the rise of a kind of neo-fascist impulse to reduce the complexity, the magnitude, the depth, and variety of patriotism to the narrow understanding that Mr. Trump himself possesses. And it's dangerous. Because when we let an official and a governmental representative define for us the exclusive property of patriotism, we are in deep trouble. Because this nation is informed by people who have had robust conversations and vigorous disagreement about what constitutes true patriotism. But we do know that nobody has a copyright on it or the exhaustive capacity to define it to the exclusion of other definitions. And his rejecting out of hand, in advance, the Philadelphia Eagles as representatives of America because of their excellence at the Super Bowl, he is undercutting a valiant and valuable tradition in America of recognizing the diversity of definitions that make up patriotism in America.
Well, of course, our president is at war with both the truth and the law. And your new book, What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America, I want to talk to you about that, obviously. But in the broader landscape, we're in a country now where there is no consensus about what is true. I mean, it is basically the truth is we are, as Lincoln said, a house divided cannot stand. But frankly, we are a house divided against ourselves in terms of the truth. You've got Trump's people in the hermetically sealed world of Fox News believing that everything is fake news except what they put out, and that what the mainstream media puts out is fake news. And clearly the opposite is true. So I don't know how you bridge that gap. I frankly don't know how the world's lone superpower can survive with no consensus about what is real.
Yeah, you know what? This is why it's good to have black people in America. Because one of the things we do is remind people, y'all just not dealing with post-truth. We've been dealing with post-truth since 1619 when they brought 20 Africans here, extracted from their resting in their African soil, and brought here to serve the will of God. That's post-truth. That's been post-truth since the assertion that human beings who are made in the image of God are not, that they are savages. What we called, what some in America call progress, indigenous people call genocide. When people during the Civil War believed that they were fighting that war in behalf of states' rights, and we knew that it was about, in genuine terms, race in America and the ability to own human beings as slaves, we were post-truth then. So what did black people do? We persisted through the odds. We kept insisting that our truths would win out. We got on the side of what we saw was victorious, which is truth will rise again and the truth will out. And we believed that ultimately that the universe would conspire with us against those who were the vicious liars, against the tradition of not only truth-telling, but of living and practicing that truth And we believed ultimately that America would identify us and accept us and acknowledge us as truthful beings, and that that truth would ultimately sway the day. And I think that we need to remind Americans who are bitterly disappointed and, in one sense, despondent about what Donald Trump represents. He ain't the worst, he ain't the first, and he won't be the last.
And he won't succeed, surely. You simply cannot turn back the clock in the ultimate sense. Okay. I mean, atavism doesn't work, does it? At least I don't think it does.
Right. So, no, absolutely not. But, it's, you know, I think the reality is that this president is seeking, through a perverted sense of nostalgia, a day in America where, you know, people of color didn't speak up, where women didn't have rights, where white people were unquestionably at the center of American culture, and those of us in the 21st century must reject and rebel against such a narrow conception of who we are as a nation.
Well, Ronald Reagan tried that back in the 80s, the idea of going back to the Ozzie and Harriet Halcyon days where blacks and Latinos were invisible. It didn't work then, so I don't see it's ever going to work, even though in the short term you do have this silo of, what, 30% in Trump land listening to the dog whistles. And my sense is that Trump and, by extension, the Republicans have rediscovered dog whistle politics, and they've revived racism as a kind of desperate last hurrah against demographics. And as somebody recently said, demographics are destiny.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that those halcyon days that are now long ago, for those who believe that they existed, must listen to Stephanie Kuntz, who writes that they never were what we said they used to be, basically. That there was always nostalgia and therefore exaggeration and therefore a bit of mendacity at the heart of our retrieval, of our retrieval of the past, of our remembrances of those pasts that are now under scrutiny and that are in competition as candidates for the source of the present. In other words, there are many versions of the past that are available to us. There are many versions of what is right and wrong, and what we have to do is to oppose as much as we can the kind of lunatic nostalgia that would be that would issue forth in a kind of a neo-fascist appropriation of the past by saying, because what Donald Trump doesn't just want to own the present, he wants to own how we interpret the past, what we used to do. You got to lie about the past in order to lie about the present. So in that sense, if demographics are destiny in terms of who gets a chance to get a seat at the table and who gets a chance to narrate the story, this is why we must never surrender our capacity as agents, even if we are less powerful than those who are doing harm to us, that we have a voice and we have a story and we have a vision and we must insist upon its being told, and we can never surrender ultimately the power and authority of our witness. That's what James Baldwin did. That's what Harry Belafonte did and Lorraine Hansberry and Lena Horne, and we've got to do the same thing today.
And Michael Eric Dyson, you're referring to a 1963 meeting that took place with Attorney General Robert Kennedy. He sought out James Baldwin to explain the rage that threatened to engulf black America. And James Baldwin brought along his friends, Lorraine Hansberry, psychologist Kenneth Clark, and the activist Jerome Smith. And it was a very uncomfortable three-hour session, was it not, for Robert Kennedy?
Absolutely, sir, because Robert Kennedy thought, when he had a meeting with, you know, these leading figures, he didn't want to meet with civil rights leaders. He wanted to meet deliberately with leading figures who were not part of the civil rights movement so that they wouldn't feel that they couldn't tell the truth, that they were more beholden to their organizations than to the truth as they saw it. So he got writers and activists who were free enough and intellectuals who were free enough to bear witness to the truth as they saw it. And Robert Kennedy thought that they were going to, you know, be grateful to him for all of the things that the Kennedy administration had done. And instead, they, you know, lit him up, so to speak. They said, no, we're not going to be grateful because you're speaking out of both sides of your mouth. You are not being honest about the need for serious engagement with the issue of race. And you're not being honest about the degree to which the rage of black people exists
because of the failed policies of even a liberal administration that was trying to at once placate white supremacists and bigots on the one hand by putting Harold Cox, who was a jurist, on the bench down south, and he would call black people niggers from the very bench he presided from. And when he promised Mr. Vandiver, the governor, I think, of Georgia, that when he was elected, he would not use the federal government to impose constraints on that state, and that he would not try to use federal authority to undermine the practices of segregation. And at the same time, he's telling black civil rights leaders and black other black leaders that he would support civil rights and perhaps one day put forth legislation to quell the racial injustice there. So they knew they were dealing with a very complicated administration, and yet, despite that, they said, unless you are honest and speak it up for that which is true and righteous, we are not going to agree with you. And they pushed, and finally, at a three-hour meeting, and for the most of that meeting, Bobby Kennedy, for the first time, had to listen to the black people and not lecture them.
And Michael Eric Dyson, in your new book, What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America, in your book, and of course today is the 50th anniversary of both the, we're having a California primary here, and 50 years ago, Bobby Kennedy won the California primary and shortly thereafter was assassinated. And you write in the book, your new book, Bobby Kennedy was the first white person I believed cared for black folk, and the sorrow and grief his death evoked in black America made me realize I wasn't alone. So it's something changed, right? Obviously with Bobby Kennedy.
Oh, Bobby Kennedy changed. I mean, well, first he was pissed. First he was mad. First he was upset. First, he was rather angry. He sicked the FBI on the people who were at that meeting. He either started or continued dossiers that the FBI had collected immorally, if not illegally, on many of the members of that meeting. And then that led, ironically and bitterly enough, to the surveillance of the FBI of Martin Luther King Jr., because his lawyer and James Baldwin's lawyer was Clarence Jones. And Clarence Jones was at that meeting, and it eventually led to the surveillance of Martin Luther King Jr. And the wiretap was authorized by Bobby Kennedy. So this was not one of his high moments or greatest days. And yet, after he simmered down and calmed down, he said, look, if I were black, I'd be full of rage as well. I would also end up thinking that if I were black, that it is, this society is not fair to me. I wouldn't necessarily want to serve my country in a war when I was not being respected at home. And it changed his mind. He took heed to their admonition that the president of the United States of America must also see race not only as a political issue, but as a moral one, and must speak out and use his bully pulpit, and that it changed his understanding of race in terms of public policies that should be pursued. And instead of being insensitive to and unempathetic with the masses of black people, he became deeply sympathetic, deeply empathetic, and began to use his own platforms to speak eloquently in behalf of the most vulnerable people in this country, including the poor and African-American people.
Well, I don't know that it's a coincidence, but J. Edgar Hoover, the two people he hated most in the world were Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. And, you know, we've obviously had too much martyrdom with both of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King. And it seems like martyrdom by definition is a way, or at least assassination is a way, to demoralize and defeat our hopes and aspirations. So how do we get out of that trap of expecting to lose? We've got to win.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, and we got to win because we ultimately believe we're on the winning side, that truth will win out, that justice will prevail, that righteousness will rise above the morass of mendacity and evil and, you know, indifference to justice. So in that sense, you know, my pastor used to tell me something. He said, don't fight for victory, fight from victory. know already that you have won, know already that you're in the right lane, the right position, the right starting point, and the right conduct for the justice you want to see brought into the world. And if you side with that from the very beginning, if it governs your speech, your actions, your thoughts, your behavior, your expectation, then you've won even before you see the victory come to fruition. So in that sense, we've got to have victories. We've got to have wins. We've got to have people who will prevail. And in order to do that, we've got to be pretty shrewd in our political analysis. And we've got to understand what it is that we must do in order to put ourselves in a position to win, to prevail, whether it's a race in California or one in, Georgia, whether it was the president of the United States of America, as, you know, Barack Obama was. And even though people weren't, you know, completely satisfied with him, and completely, that's understandable, he did register a victory of sorts for, you know, certain varieties of progressive people and moderately progressive people. So, you know, what we've got to do is understand that this is a vicious game and that we've got to play it. We can't be perfectionists. We can't say that, you know, as in the last election. Let me give an example. Some of my black compatriots on the left said, well, there's no difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Could you say that now? Could you actually believe that now? Could you not believe that as bad as you thought Hillary Clinton might have performed, that she certainly wouldn't have performed as poorly as Mr. Trump is now? So in that sense, I think that we shouldn't make, as the old saying goes, the perfect the enemy of the good. And we got to figure out ways that we can leverage the moral authority and political influence we possess in behalf of the masses of people who need our representation and, to a degree, our leadership.
Well, Michael Eric Dyson, I thank you very much for joining us here today on this 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy.
I appreciate you, brother. You're one of the sharpest and most eloquent interviews I've had. So thank you, sir.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, my man.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Eric Dyson, one of America's premier public intellectuals and the author of the New York Times bestseller, Tears We Cannot Stop. And his latest book just out is What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and Our Unfinished Conversation About Race in America. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with a former law clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall about the latest twists and turns as Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, now faces jail for witness tampering.